Mount, Representative Herron, Representative Josephson, Representative Sadler, and myself, Chair Olson. We have two members excused, Representative Reinbold and Millet. Let the record reflect, we do have a quorum to conduct business. A lot of familiar faces, welcome back, everyone. Please turn off your cell phones. We have four bills on the calendar today, House Bill 203, House Bill 282, House Bill 230, and House Bill 316. We'll be going through them in that order. First up will be House Bill 203, and looks like we've got Jim Pound from the carrying the bill. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Right. Good afternoon, everyone, members of the committee. I'm Jim Pound, staff to Representative Wes Keller. House Bill 203 marks a change in the health care insurance policy in the state of Alaska. It adds a step to the process for insurers to make payments to out-of-network providers. It requires, in most cases, that out-of-network providers providers receive payment that they run through both the patient and the provider. The effect here is sort of twofold. The patient actually gets to see how much a procedure costs. The other side is, because it could slow down the process a little bit, there's an incentive for providers to become part of the network. As you can see, there are advantages to that as well. If you look in your packet, you'll notice that I used the state of Alaska's healthcare program. That's basically shows the difference in cost between in-network and out-of-network, and that is the healthcare system that we're under right now with our new carrier started in January. This translates into savings for both the insurer and essentially for the patient. The goal here, which was provided for, is to create a market-based basis for insurance coverage and to increase the incentives for providers to become part of a network. And to be honest, we have with us right now Lynn Soren, who is probably better qualified to answer questions and discuss with you the reasons for this bill coming into existence.
Lynn, are you with us? You certainly are.
I am, Chair Olson. Thank you.
Now, please raise yourself onto the record and continue.
For the record, Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. For the record, I am Len Soren, Vice President of Congressional Legislative Affairs with Premera Blue Cross. Premera provides coverage to over 100,000 Alaskan residents, offering coverage for individual, small group, and large employers, as well as offering services for large self-insured groups. I'm joining you today testifying in support of House Bill 203, a measure that is critical in Alaska's ongoing struggle to moderate its extremely high health care costs. Current Alaska law requires health plans to pay non-contracted providers directly for care. This requirement removes a significant incentive that providers have to enter into negotiated contracts with health plans at lower rates. Direct payment from the health plan is typically one of the major benefits that providers obtain from contracting with health plans. House Bill 203 will rebalance that contracting dynamic in Alaska by allowing health plans to issue a joint check made out to both the member and the provider, leading to more negotiated agreements with health plans, helping to moderate Alaska health care costs. Alaska has the second highest health care spending per capita of any state in the nation. Here are some eye-catching examples for you to consider. Alaska has the highest annual average cost for employee health benefits in the nation at $11,926 per employee, twice what employers pay in some other states. And it is getting worse. In the last decade, health care costs in Anchorage increased at a rate 70% above the national average. And the problem extends across a full range of care in Alaska. I want to share some examples based on the Milliman report that was done for the Alaska Health Care Commission not too very long ago that examined costs across Alaska and compared them to reference states. Physician reimbursement in Alaska is approximately 160% of the average in the comparison states, those states being Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Wyoming in the Milliman report. Cardiologists in the state of Alaska charge an average of 83% higher than in the comparison states. Hip replacements cost roughly 350% higher in Alaska than in Washington state, and diagnostic colonoscopies are 150% more in Alaska than in Washington. Additional data shows that certain specialty services in Alaska are over 500% of Medicare reimbursement. For example, musculoskeletal services in Alaska are 600% of Medicare, and cardiovascular services are 762% of the level of Medicare reimbursement. So what can the state of Alaska do about this cost crisis? Not too long ago, the Alaska Healthcare Commission, as I mentioned, took a very hard look at exactly that question. The commission had several suggestions, some of which related to provider pricing power in Alaska. As you may hear from the chair of the Healthcare Commission later in this, the former chair of the Healthcare Commission later in this hearing, doing away with the direct pay requirement that is before you today was one of those recommendations. And while the direct pay requirement has certainly increased costs, these cost increases have been aggravated by another requirement in state law, the 80th percentile requirement, that mandates health plans pay non-contracted providers at least 80% of their usual and customary rate. So what ends up occurring in certain communities and in certain specialties, providers are able to dictate their own usual and customary rate by simply increasing their own rates to whatever level they wish. This leaves health plans and Alaskan consumers with only the hope of a negotiated contract as a means to moderate health care costs in Alaska. And this is where a change in the direct pay requirement will have a substantial impact on Alaskan health care costs. For evidence of this, we only need to look at Primera's recent experience with the Federal Employee Program Health Plan in Alaska, which, as you know, covers a fairly healthy proportion of Alaskan citizens. The FEP program instituted a joint check policy exactly as we are proposing in House Bill 203 in July of 2012. We almost immediately saw 11 new contracts negotiated with providers after only having one in the prior couple of months. One sole source community hospital entered into a negotiated agreement with us after 5 years of non-contracted status. This means that more consumers have access to broader networks without the risk of higher out-of-pocket costs. It's clear that a co-payee check system worked for the FEP program in Alaska, and it will work in the commercial insured market as well. House Bill 203 will immediately interest more providers in joining thousands of their colleagues who have contracts with Premier and other carriers across the state, allowing Alaskans and employers to access more affordable care and increasing access for everyone. Thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? In fact, Mr. Sorensen's on a tight schedule, which is why I've moved him up to the beginning. But any questions?
Thank you.
Representative Joseph.
Well, a lot of this is useful for other legislation as well to know about. Mr. Sorensen, as I understand it, fundamentally, this bill is designed to send a payment to the patient rather than the physician when the physician is not in the network. Is that the essence of it?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. May I follow up?
Follow up.
Okay. It strikes me a couple things. The first thing is, in some instances, the check is written out to two payees, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yeah, under this bill, in every instance, it would be written as a co-payee check with the provider as the first named payee and the member as the second named payee.
Right. Through the chair. So as a hypothetical illustration, if John Smith gets a check made out either in part or in whole to reimburse him, dependent on his contract or his invoice or bill with his own provider, wouldn't he now need to get in his car and drive to the doctor's office to get a signature?
No. What typically happens, through the chair, Representative Josephson, what typically happens is that the member will endorse the check and send it on to the provider, and the provider will then endorse it and deposit it as payment for the services.
Okay.
New question?
Yes, new question. What if John Smith doesn't do that? He's then sued by the provider?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if the consumer, for whatever reason, does not forward the check to the provider, the provider would then bill the consumer as they would bill them in any other circumstance. In our view, this change allows us to, at the outset, send the check to the person with whom we have an agreement. That is the benefit contract for health care coverage. Mm-hmm. Those people have purchased coverage through us, and for non-contracted care, we would simply be sending the check to the person that has an agreement with us. Mm-hmm. They should certainly send the check on to the provider, and there would typically be a member education process that took place in connection with this change, mm-hmm. but it is intended that they endorse this check and send it on to the provider. If they don't, the provider would then be in the position of collecting from the member. And avoiding having to do so mm-hmm. is exactly the sort of incentive to enter into network contracts with health plans that we think will balance the contracting dynamic between physicians and health plans in Alaska.
If I could, it sounds to me that at least at the outset, this could be a headache for a member, but I think, Mr. Soren, your response, and I don't mean to suggest that I know, is that in the long run, rates will come down, and that's because more physicians will subscribe to the PPO plan. Is that the idea?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes. Our intent is to expand the range and number of contracted providers in Alaska mm-hmm. to provide more people care at lower cost. Again, the significant incentive is that it's far easier and more quicker for the provider to obtain payment from us. Depending upon whether the provider, in his or her own independent judgment, wants to bill the member directly or would want to wait to obtain the co-payee check from the member, it may or may not cause a consumer to get billed for that cost of care. The member, though, has already received a check from us. So in the event they got billed for the cost of care, they then would forward that amount we paid to them onto the provider in payment.
Just a couple more. I know that I'm sensing an airplane is at the airport. Are there some instances, Mr. Soren, where the patient, like me, would just assume I never know even what happened except for I get an EOB at the end mm-hmm. that I'd glance at very fast. In other words, the payment would be sent to the doctor. It's all good by me. I don't have to deal with this. Isn't that, as a consumer, isn't that the easier way to go?
Well, it might be the easiest way to go in, through the chair, Representative Josephson, it might be the easiest way to go in a single instance, mm-hmm. but that easy way to go in a single instance, again, I think robs health plans and the healthcare market of a significant tool. In combination with the 80th percentile regulation, denies a significant tool to create more balanced health plan negotiating leverage with providers in Alaska, which would, over the longer term, help lower health care costs for everyone.
Just one last.
It's about behavior modification.
Right. My last question, I didn't know if you meant for me.
No,
it will be short ways. I did feel a sort of chill. When I go to the doctor, even though I have the means and I shouldn't be this way, I see this little placard that says payment due on delivery. Mm-hmm. Often they say your copay is $100, we'll talk to you later, and I'm happy to do that. Will that still be my happy experience? Or will they say, geez, you're going to get the check, you may move to Toke, mm-hmm. and we don't know Toke, and we're never going to find you again?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I can't predict how any given provider would behave. We would hope that rather than asking for $7,000 at the time of service for someone to receive services, that they would wait to receive the endorsed co-pay e-check from the member. But I
thank you.
Representative Heron.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I've looked at the list of documents underneath 203. Is there any opposition to 203?
I think we'll be hearing some, yeah.
Okay. Then I'll save my comments till then.
Yeah, it's not my intention to move the bill today. We're going to have lots of public testimony in the next few days, I believe. Any further questions for Mr. Soren? Thanks again. At this time, the members have a blank CS in their packets, and I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chairman. I would move the committee adopt CSHB 203, work order 28-LS0682, /C for Charlie, as our working document.
And I'll object, and the purpose is to allow Jim to explain the CS rather than going through both of them. We can work off the CS. And, thank you again, Mr. Sorn.
Thank you, Chair Olson. My pleasure.
So, Mr. Chairman, we're looking at version C, right? Okay. Thank you.
See if I can get his microphone far enough away from me this time, Mr. Chairman. Once again, Jim Pound, staff representative Keller. The C version, we kind of expanded out from the original version a little bit. First of all, in Section 1, there is the ability for an insurer to pay upon written request directly to an out-of-network provider. But again, it is upon a written request from the patient. That is new language that came into this one as well. Also, Section 5 now is what was in the original bill to pay the amounts due under the health insurance policy for covered services rendered by an out-of-network provider. We tend to call them, I believe, preferred providers from experience on the non-insurance side of it. And it's essentially the same process where if you go online, you'll see that. Also, again, in Section 2 on page 3, again, it has to do with the written request, and this has to do with the changes here primarily between hospital and provider language. It narrows somewhat the definition of where the money actually goes directly to a hospital and not per se to a practitioner or a provider of health insurance or a small clinic. It's directly aimed at just a hospital. Again, the same situation in Section 3 where we added out-of-network hospital as opposed to provider of service. These were cleanup languages, things that were not, they weren't in the original bill because it just wasn't noticed at the time that we needed to make these changes to overall correct the bill. It greatly expanded it as far as page numbers are concerned, but it just basically corrected the term provider to make it to hospital.
I do think you've got a sympathetic crowd, at least on this side of the table, with that issue.
Yes. And that's pretty much the changes between C and the original version.
Any questions for Jim?
So, Mr. Chairman, yeah.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, I want to make sure I understand. So the purpose of Sections 2 and 3 is not to narrow the scope of medical service providers that can receive direct payment, or is it, you say it's a definitional cleanup, or is it actually a constriction of the universe of providers that can receive direct payment from
Chair, as I perceive it, it is actually a limit. It limits it down from providers to hospital.
Okay. We'll probably, we may hear from surgeons or clinics or others that might have a view on that.
Oh, I got a feeling we're
going to
be here.
Mr. Representative Sadler.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
And a zero fiscal note. Still.
Still.
Any further questions for Mr. Pound? With that, I think I'm going to bring Marty Hester up, Deputy
Chair.
Director of the Division of Insurance. I'm assuming that although he didn't sign up for a statement, that there's probably at least one or two questions. Representative Josephson?
Not at this time, no.
Oh. Guess what, Marty? You got off light.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to be around?
Yes, sir.
With that, we'll open up public testimony. And I can't believe it. There's nobody in the room that wants to testify on this bill or standing in the hallway or Well, with that, we will go outside the room. Anchorage, Ohio, Mike Humphrey, you with us today, Mike?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you for calling in today, and please state your name and affiliation, and you've got our undivided attention.
My name is Mike Humphrey. I live in Anchorage, and I'm with the Wilson Agency, and we specialize in human resource and benefits consulting across the state of Alaska. And I to speak in support of HB 203. In my prior employment, before I joined the Wilson Agency about two years ago, I spent 20 years as the system-wide director of benefits for the University of Alaska. In that role, it was my job to set the strategic direction for the University of Alaska's benefit programs, health plans, wellness, retirement offices, offerings, family medical leave, the list goes on. My prime focus for the university and my current clients over the last 2 years has been helping them find ways to slow down the escalation of healthcare costs, which is the biggest cost for nearly every employer out there. Employers really only have about three tools that they can use to address healthcare plan costs: plan redesign, shifting costs to employees, asking the provider community to join a network, or using wellness programs to change the health status of their employees. When it comes to cost shifting, that's very upsetting to the employees' morale. Wellness programs take 3 to 5 years to show a return. So my preference and my employer's preferences that I represent is to work with the medical community and develop incentives for them to join a provider network. Over the years, I've had many conversations with providers, both large and small, about the willingness to join a provider network. To take some of their fear out of joining a provider network, I've shown them the impact on their top 20 procedures, illustrated the impact on the cash flow. However, most of the time, my efforts did not result in a provider joining. Being good business people, they were quick to realize that I really had nothing to offer that would increase the turnaround time between the time they submitted their bill to the insurance company and it being deposited in their bank account. They fully understood the time value of money. All I was offering the provider was a reduced reimbursement in exchange for an increase in the number of patients that were showing up because I would be actively marketing their network. Passage of HB 203 will allow the offering of something in return so that the providers may join the network and hopefully help control healthcare costs. Thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you again for joining us. Any questions for Mr. Humphrey? Thanks
Mr.
again.
Mr. Humphrey? Or Mr.
Representative Sadler.
Mr. Humphrey, through the chair, actually, you gave three options as ways to hold healthcare costs under control. You said a networkizing provides the quickest turnaround. Is that the largest savings, or is wellness or plan redesign the largest savings?
Network, through the chair, plan redesign obviously has an immediate impact on the employees, but it doesn't take cost out of the healthcare plan. Wellness programs are a long-term initiative to manage the population's health. The most immediate return would be for a provider to accept a discount by joining a network.
Okay. Good deal. Thanks.
Seeing no further questions, thanks again, Mr. Humphrey. James Brooks, Alaska Medical Association.
Hello, sir. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
So I'm James Brooks. I'm the executive director of Providence Anchorage Anesthesia Med Group, and Mike Hogan from the State Medical Association asked me to call. Chairman Olson and members of the committee, first I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm going to be brief. I'm opposed to this legislation because of its impact on your constituents and our patients. Our patients have the same right to efficient claims adjudication and remittance of payments to providers, whether they are served by a participating provider or a non-PAR provider. And they should be afforded the same rights as hospitals that are staffed with teams of healthcare professionals to process claims and payments. The entire healthcare industry is implementing electronic health records, electronic claim submission, and being paid with electronic remittance to reduce cost and complexity of care for the patient. And this legislation is going to use a two-party paper check system for remittance of monies due to providers. To me, this defies logic. The legislation is going to increase the complexity of payment for services. Patients are going to now have to act to convey a check from themselves to the providers of services. Patients with guardians, surrogates, and other third parties assisting in their care may actually struggle to get this process accomplished. I think the process change will initially confuse some patients, as was testified earlier. It's going to definitely increase their amount of paperwork, and the communications that patients are going to face after they come back from having health care. It's going to delay reimbursement from patients to providers. Once it delays reimbursement and increases the AR cycle, it's going to elevate cost. As it elevates cost, you may have some providers that are going to sign networks. You may have some other providers that are going to pass that cost on. And frankly, I just think it's bad legislation. It's illogical legislation. And it's a step back to how business was done 20 or 30 years ago, but it's not basically the pattern for increasing efficiency in the whole business side of healthcare. So I think it imposes a risk of failure on our patients, and as, again, previously testified, if a patient is out of town, out of state, or for whatever reason doesn't process their mail, then they're going to have the risk of having a payment due to a provider sitting somewhere or get lost, and they're going to still ultimately be responsible for that payment. So I think this legislation is actually shifting a burden to the patients and shifting a burden to your constituents in order to benefit an insurance network. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'll take your questions.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Yeah,
I thought you had one.
I do, and I don't. It's more of a comment, if I could. When I'm thinking of someone like Premier Blue Cross, to this day, I don't know whether I'm dealing with sort of a corporation with a profit motive or a co-op. And boy, would that go a long way to helping me know how I feel about this sort of thing. But that's just a comment. I just don't know.
Unfortunately, that's not part of the bill before us, but I would suspect that somebody should be able to get back to you shortly on that. Next up is Representative Sadler.
Mr. Brooks, through the chair, you opine that this would move us backwards in the past of checks and so forth, which seems to be the golden days back in the 70s and 80s when checks were the thing to do. But you're saying electronic health records is the trend. Does EHR currently envision just electronic transfer payments between patients and insurers and providers? Is that the way things are going?
So right now we already have electronic health records. We electronically submit the vast majority of our claims so that there's no paper being processed by most entities, payers, and then finally most of them electronically remit to us today and we simply post those payments. This is totally transparent to my patients. I am a participating provider with Blue Cross Blue Shield. If every company in the state operated like Blue Cross Blue Shield, I would not have a problem with much of this. But you have some other insurance companies that try to do business in this state, and let's just say they're very corporate. So they have a very bottom-line incentive for how this whole check process is going to work. Every company doing business in the state is not Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield and is not represented by the folks that are there testifying today. And some of those insurance companies are already sending out paper checks and defying your law today. I know because some of my employees are getting them to be used to pay for their services. And it's already affecting providers. So I just think you can't take a quality company like Blue Cross Blue Shield and assume that everybody that's doing business in this state is going to operate the way Jeff Davis and his team of people would operate. There's a lot of other folks out there, and they're far less ethical.
Follow-up, sir. You said you are a member of the Blue Cross Blue Shield, I'm sorry, the Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield network, and you must...
Sure, so I don't have any economic skin in the game when it comes to Blue Cross Blue Shield, okay? I promise you there's a lot of other insurers in this state, though, that I wouldn't sign a contract with them for anything. Not because of economics, because of the horrible terms that are embedded in their contracts.
My question to you was, you said you are a participating member of Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield, so you are an in-network provider, is that correct, my understanding?
Yes.
Okay, and do they require you as part of the terms of that contract to submit your claims electronically?
I don't know that it's required. It's how we do business with them. And they electronically remit back to us.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Byron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to you, Mr. Brooks, is I guess I believe I understand your concern. So what's being proposed here, using your words, this is going back years and it becomes a real paper process. But within the electronic transfer, couldn't there be essentially electronic two-payee system where the customer would have to electronically acknowledge that this is true and the care provider would then get paid? Would you prefer that?
I'm not quite sure how that process that you're discussing would work. When we get hundreds of payments for hundreds of different patients sent to us by different providers, it could be Medicaid, it could be Medicare, it could be Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield, et cetera. They come in and we're posting those things in very much a mass production style method. If I have to wait for every patient to electronically come back and sign, I'm not so sure that's going to function. We frankly take care of an awful lot of patients that don't even know how to do email and are going to struggle if you put another step in this process. I mean, you are folks that author the Healthcare Decisions Act and actually have guardians and surrogates acting on behalf of patients right now because you know the limitations of some of the people we serve. If we complicate the process for them, I'm not quite sure how they're going to deal with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What kind of impact is this going to have on your back office staffing?
It's going to cost me money. I'm going to have to now chase patients to bring me one payment at a time and sign that off. I'm going to have more staff. I'll give you an example. Right now, there's significant problems with payment of claims and processing of claims by Medicaid. I've already had to expand my staff to deal with that because it just doesn't magically happen. When a healthcare financial cycle changes because someone changes a process, whether they're rolling out a new information system or they're putting another step in the process, it will cost the providers of the state money. And we are par with Blue Cross Blue Shield, right? But I promise you, many other practices are going to have to hire more people to deal with this and chase down patients and try to get the check either mailed in or brought to the office and get them signed appropriately.
Well, thanks again, Mr. Brooks. Rick Watson, are you with us?
Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And, I've got a feeling I know what you're going to say, but fire away.
My name is Rick Watson. I'm the CEO of Orthopedic Physicians Anchorage, a group of 31 providers specializing in orthopedic surgery and rheumatology here in Anchorage. Chairman Olson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Bill 203 today. Most of the orthopedic surgeons in Alaska, including ours, are non-contracted out-of-network providers. We have no contractual relationships with commercial insurance carriers. Our concern with House Bill 203 is primarily for the effect it will have on patients. When patients come to us for care, we offer to verify their insurance benefits for them, obtain required pre-authorizations for them, file claims with their insurance company for them, and notify them when their insurance pays. We do this as a courtesy. Insurance companies refuse to tell us what they will pay in advance, so we have to give patients estimates and explain that the actual amount they will owe can't be known until the insurance company pays. Patients are understandably frustrated by that and readily assign their insurance benefit payments to us, so the insurance companies will pay us directly and they won't have to deal with it. Payments on those claims are frequently delayed for long periods as insurance companies routinely request more and more information. Patients and insurance companies have come to expect all this from providers, even those of us who are not contracted with them. Consequently, almost no patients understand this process or are prepared to do it on their own. We do it to spare them the time, the frustration, and the worry so they can focus on getting better. We consistently find that patients don't understand their insurance policies or the contractual relationship they have with their insurance company. Many mistakenly think the insurance company will pay it all and they will owe nothing. We are dumbfounded why insurance companies make so little effort to help their enrollees understand these things and expect us to do the explaining. We shudder to think what would happen to patients if we billed them 100% direct and if they had to file their own claims and get their own pre-authorizations and try to get reimbursed. House Bill 203 proposes to strip patients of their right to assign insurance benefits to their physicians. By allowing insurance companies to write checks to both the patient and the non-contracted provider, require co-signatures on those checks, and not require formal assignment of benefits, House Bill 203 makes the state of Alaska complicit in misleading patients to think a formal contractual relationship exists between their insurance company and their non-contractor provider when one does not. This will further confuse patients. As referenced earlier by Mr. Soren, several months ago, Federal Blue Cross stripped patients of their right to assign benefits to their non-contractor providers. All reimbursement checks are now sent directly to the patient, not the provider, as House Bill 203 proposes. Many of those patients still don't understand why they are getting those checks. Many just hold them, not knowing what to do. Some misplace them. Many sense a windfall and cash those checks and spend the money. When the bill arrives to pay their physician, they no longer have the funds. As a consequence of this, non-contracted providers were forced to require up to 50% advance deposits from those patients. I'm concerned that with House Bill 203, many more patients will not have the means to afford such deposits and their care will be delayed. There are other concerns with House Bill 203. If the insurance company overpays, will the patient be required to co-sign the reimbursement in the same way they did the payment? If the insurance company underpays, will the patient need to get involved to make it right? Why is it important to preserve patient rights to assign benefits to hospitals, but not their physician or a surgery center? House Bill 203 drives another wedge between patients and their non-contracted provider. It further increases patient confusion, draws patients into an administrative role they clearly don't want or understand or are prepared to take, and imposes a financial risk on them that could delay their care and increase their debt. Thank you for listening. I'm happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you again. Any questions? Is there anybody else online? Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? I'm planning on keeping public testimony open. And with that, I will remove my objection to adopting the CS. And if there's no further objection, seeing none, the CS is adopted. And we will hold this bill over. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record, the next item on the calendar today is House Bill 282. We first heard this bill on February 28th. During that meeting, we had a motion to adopt the CS, ACS, version /O and took some public testimony. When we adjourned, I maintained my objection to the CS. At this point in time, I will lift my objection. Seeing no further objection, the CS /O is adopted. We've got Brenda Hewitt back representing the sponsor to give us a brief summary of the bill, of the CS.
Great. Hi, my name is Brenda Hewitt. I am staff to Representative Doug Isaacson, who regrets that he is not with us right at the moment. He's off getting his tooth fixed. So,
by another member of the body? Or?
Well, actually, he had to wait till Thursday to do that one, so he's getting one here in Juneau. So my apologies anyway. Would you like me to go back through the bill again?
Just briefly.
This bill we've been working on for several months to tweak the Landlord-Tenant Act. It has served the state of Alaska for some time now, but over a period of time, there were some issues that came up. We had a couple of constituents who asked us to deal with that. Some of the things that you'll find in this bill now, in working with the landlord groups, with property managers, with realtors, we have to say that we are really pleased with and appreciative of the broad statewide support we've been getting for the bill. It will allow both tenants and landlords to have a mutual basis of condition of the property, which should eliminate conflicts. This will help alleviate some load off of our legal system. We were able to add in some protection for domestic violence victims. We were able to allow for an additional deposit for those people who want to have pets where landlords want them to be. We have found ways to accommodate returning deposits to those people who have to deal with damages. So there's a number of, we've made a differentiation between service animals and comfort animals, and a couple of other things. I think you have some people who will be testifying today, so I'll stay back from that. One of the things I'd like to highlight that we were able to take care of between the last hearing and this hearing, we did work with the victims of domestic violence to propose an amendment that would allow people who are...
And actually, I think that'll be coming up.
That'll be coming up later, so I can leave that one alone.
About a minute and a half.
Excellent. And then we have online Ed Niffen with the Department of Law. One of the issues that had come up was making sure that landlords understood if they are under federal regulations, that there are different laws that they need to follow. And in talking with the Department of Law, they publish a wonderful booklet that is used by landlords to note what they're supposed to be doing and by tenants. So they're saying that they can incorporate a lot of those directions within that handbook. So I wanted to thank them ahead of time for that. And I'm available for questions.
Representative Joseph?
Just because I stepped out in the hallway just and missed the first 5 seconds. Brenda, we're looking at version O.
Version O.
This is essentially, with the exception of this small amendment, the same thing we looked at before.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have any other questions.
And seeing no further questions, the committee members do have an amendment in their packet, and I would entertain a motion to adopt amendment number one.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the committee adopt amendment, call it amendment number one, work order 28-LS0930/0.1.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Brenda, you want to walk us through the amendment?
It's a quick one. In the transient housing section, the sexual assault folks asked us to add this. Occupancy by an individual who is a victim of sexual assault, stalking, or domestic violence, who is receiving housing assistance from a victim counseling center. In this paragraph, it means that distinguished in AS 1866-250. For instance, if a man and his children need housing because they're victims of domestic violence, they can't house them at the shelter. So they do put them in housing that they pay for and take care of. In that case, we want them to continue to be able to fall under transient housing.
Any questions?
Well, Representative Josephson? Related to that, so in other words, in that hypothetical, they would enjoy, upon, I suppose, some evidence, the benefit of being able to be released from their contract.
Absolutely.
And I'll lift my objection. Are there any further objections to adopting amendment number one? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. And I think at this point in time, we will go to public testimony, which we had opened previously. And I think for the committee's knowledge, we have Ed Sniffen online for questions only, Department of Law, AG Department of Law out of Anchorage. If we get to questions for Ed, and in the room, Ruth Blackwell. Nope. Questions?
Is it
We also have Stacy Schubert from Alaska Housing for questions, if anybody has any questions from Stacy. I have lots of questions, but... Pamela Cook, Fairbanks. Are you with us, Ms. Cook?
Yes.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us.
My name is Pamela Cook, and I work for MB Management. I am a licensed realtor. Even though I'm licensed, I don't do anything with sales. I mainly do property management. And I haven't testified before, so I'm not quite sure how to do this. I'm assuming that we're just telling you that I am, you know, for all these changes that we are proposing or are being proposed on the House Bill 282. We had specific changes that we rallied for, specifically the changing the security deposit return date from 14 days to 30 days. We often find ourselves without enough time. Within those 14 days, there's usually two weekends, which basically cuts it down to 10 days to return it, if we're lucky that there's not a holiday. You know, there's a lot of things that can come up, like people that have smoked in the units, people that have pets. When we inspect the units on their final day, the carpets are usually have just been cleaned. You know, the place smells great, pine sol and bleach and all that, but usually after a few days or even up to a week, those smells come back, which really cuts down into, you know, returning the deposit within 14 days. You know, if we have to tear out carpets, replace drywall, replace doors, that kind of stuff, you know, we honestly, I try to get it off my desk as soon as possible. You know, if I can get it out before the 14 days, that's great. I've often even returned it at the inspection if I knew, like, the tenant was, we have a lot of military and they're getting ready to deploy, so I would give them their check at the inspection if everything cleared. A few of the things that we run into other than, like, the smoking and the pet smells, and in the Alaska Landlord Tenant Act, for abandoned belongings, we're required to give the tenant 15 days to remove their property, which kind of overlaps that 14-day period. Oftentimes, we shove all that stuff into a corner if we can to avoid having to take it off-site and store it. But if we have a renter that wants to move in, you know, we're kind of scrambling on the 14th day to return a deposit, but also try to move stuff off-site, store it, and then have to go back and dispose of it after the 14-day window. Another one of the big things that we have is the utility companies. Most of them don't come after the landlord if the tenants don't pay when they leave, but the water company is one of our bigger ones. They don't even generate the bills usually like 2 weeks after the meter read, which is well past the 14 days, so we're having to, you know, guesstimate what that final water bill is going to be. So those are just some of the reasons that we would really like to see that 14 days go up to 30 days. My understanding is a lot of the other states have a 30-day return, and just because if it changes to 30 days doesn't mean we're going to take the full 30 days. It's just sometimes we really need more than 14 days to do it the right way. One of the other big things is the pet fees increase, which would really help us because we have so many people that come into Alaska with pets. And if we have a rental with a lot of carpets, we don't rent to somebody with pets because no amount of deposit is going to cover, 2,000 square feet of carpet. So, you know, by increasing it just a little, by allowing us to do 2 months for the deposits and then an additional another month for if they have pets, that's really going to help us out. The professional carpet cleaning has been another thing that we've had to deal with. A lot of tenants have challenges on that. We think it's just a common courtesy if we give it to you professionally clean. A lot of tenants want it professionally clean, and then come when they move out, you know, they don't want to be bothered with it. They don't have the money because they have the expenses. We understand that, but that's, you know, they have the deposit. So we think that if we give it to them professionally clean, it should be returned to us professionally clean. I think that's also covered in one of the sections that, you know, it's Section 13, that, you know, we just ask that the tenant return the premises to us in substantially the same condition it was given to them. We have some tenants that return it to us in better condition. and we understand normal wear and tear, and that has also been the description has been clarified, because we've often had problems with that as far as what, you know, we consider normal wear and tear, what a tenant considers normal wear and tear, and what a judge considers normal wear and tear. So that section there is also appreciated. One of the other things that I just wanted to
Ms. Burke, I wonder if I could ask you to wrap it up. We're going to actually try to get the bill out of here today and up for a vote.
Okay. The only other question I had was for the number of occupancies. We were just discussing that. We have quite a few people that want to, you know, a family of seven that want to move into a one-bedroom apartment. That's covered in there, but it's not really, it doesn't really clarify. it just says by applicable law. We've honestly tried to find that in the state and federal law and haven't found it anywhere other than in the HUD. So I don't know if that law can be referenced or if we can find out, you know, what law is so that we can have that handy to show tenants that, you know, seven people in a one-bedroom apartment, you know, we want to be able to turn them away legally.
It may be in your city or borough ordinances. I'm not positive, but I think it is in mine at least, and I believe it is in Anchorage, but could possibly be there.
Okay, well, that's all I had.
Thanks again, and Antoinette Brewer, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Antoinette Brewer. I work for Coldwell Banker as a property manager and realtor. In Fairbanks.
And I'm betting you like this bill.
Sorry. I wanted to go on to the permits of the victims of domestic abuse. I understand that being in that situation at one time in my life, that getting out of that situation is very, you know, ASAP within a 24-hour period. My only question is do the people now, one side is staying, one side's leaving, in They're going to be able to give 10 days to get out now. Are they providing paperwork? Granted, they've already been through a lot. Do you see what I'm saying? Is it like, you know, do I have a police report, or how is that going to work? It would be my question.
Actually, I can't answer that, but the bill is going to be going before several other committees before either passes into law or dies at the end of the session, and for me to even guess on that would be presumptive, because I have no idea what's going to happen in future committees. But that is a very good question. You might bring it up with the sponsor's office.
Okay, I just wanted to know that. And then, of course, and the next one would be the eviction of tenants for illegal activities. And here it just says, such as drug manufacturing, dealing, or prostitution. What about youth? Would be my next question on that one. Just to give an example, I had a gentleman who went in and fixed a furnace for me and noticed in the garage that there was a couple of paraphernalia in there along with some pipes, and he had taken a picture of it. But, I mean, unfortunately, it got lost, and he wasn't able to give me the picture, so I had proof. But I would be concerned about that because, of course, whenever you bring up to the tenant, they're going to not admit to it. The only other one, I think that was the only ones I had questions on. I believe that is the ones I had questions on.
Well, thank you again for joining us today. And Kirk Menard, are you with us? Maynard?
Yes, sir. Kirk Maynard, owner broker, Coldwell Banker, Fairbanks, Alaska. And now, knowing the spirit of the testimony is really to discuss the amendment in regards to permits a victim of domestic abuse, early termination. In the essence of time, I really don't have anything else to say. We'll probably reach out to Brenda Hewitt and pick another venue to discuss the talking points. But I do support everything that Ms. Cook had to offer, and we also have the same concerns.
I'd like the record to reflect that we've been joined by the sponsor of the bill, Representative Isaacson, who is smiling and drooling from his dental work. But thanks again for calling in today.
appreciate it.
Dick Block, Anchorage. Richard Block.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for giving me a few minutes to address House Bill 282. I must confess, and I will take
responsibility. Could you state your affiliation for the record?
I'm sorry, yes.
I'm probably the only one in the room who's known you for 35 years, but...
And I'm a manager of Mellon Investment Company. And Mellon Investment Company is a company that owns property. We currently have over 110 rental units that we own and manage. And I must take, I guess, personal responsibility for not being aware that this bill was being worked on earlier, but I discovered it about a week ago and began discussions with Brenda, and have since had a chance to look at least version /O. I think there are, I have written a position paper which was sent down to Juno yesterday, and I hope that you have it either in front of you or available to you. I will not read it, but I would really seriously urge you all to look at it, because while a lot of the things in HB 282 are worthy of being considered and favorably adopted, there are a number of things that I think raise very serious questions, some of which have been addressed even by the proponents of the bill, that I think warrant slow-belling this a little bit while we work out some of the kinks. I will not address, there's like 15 proposed changes, and I really want to focus on only two.
Oh, Dick, the letter did show up. We have it before us.
What's that?
We have a copy of your letter before us. So if you want to make specific reference.
Well, yeah, I will only address orally two of the points, and I'll try to be as brief as I can about them. The first one, I believe, deals with a number of sections referred to it, but I'll deal with Section 6. And it has to do with the inclusion of the language normal wear and tear. And the question becomes, what is the standard to which we expect tenants to return the apartment when they vacate it? And one of my big concerns about utilizing this term normal wear and tear is it becomes, that plus the definition, becomes a lightning rod for litigation. And as someone has already said, one person's destruction is another person's wear and tear. And I really do not believe that that should be the standard. The landlord-tenant law, including as a result of changes in this bill, requires now that there be a pre-tenancy condition statement signed by the landlord and signed by the tenant. And it strikes me that the pre-tenancy condition statement becomes the standard for what the apartment should look like when it is returned at the end of the tenancy, and make no allowance for excuses that denting in the walls, holes in the doors, stains in the carpet are the result of reasonable wear and tear. So there may be a way to clean this up so that it satisfies those who want a clearer definition, and I'm happy to work with people on it, but my own view at the moment is it is unsatisfactory. The second thing that I would like to address has to do with this the issue of those people who are victims of abuse being able to unilaterally terminate a lease. I really do understand what the problems are from the victim's point of view, but I am not sure they're problems that ought to be made the responsibility of the landlord. The landlord has made the space available. The parties who are tenants have signed an agreement to be responsible for the financial and occupancy obligations, and there should be no way in which a tenant can unilaterally abrogate those responsibilities. Now, I would just point out that, if two people occupying a residence are buying the residence, and there is a falling out and one has to leave, the departing occupant cannot write a letter to the bank and saying, I'm no longer going to make payments on the note. They are obligated on that, no matter what may be the situation among the individuals that are occupying the property. There may be some harmonious mid-ground where we can find a way to allow an abused tenant to leave but in my view, it would have to be with provisions that maintain that tenant's legal obligations for everything up to the termination of the tenancy, including returning the property in its previous condition. As I said, there are a number of other areas where I think there should be some cleanup, maybe, and some clarification. Many of the amendments are well done, and I stand ready to help in any way I can, and I apologize for being a latecomer. But those are my two primary concerns. I guess I have another concern as well, and that is there's the statements have been made that landlords have been included in this drafting process. There very well may have been some, but in the documents that I've been sent, I see brokers and I see managers, but I don't see any people that really have their financial investment in the real estate, that we would have a chance to participate in that. Thank you very much.
Well, I might add that the sponsor is shaking his head yes, and I believe that if you contact them either later this afternoon or on Monday, we will be holding the bill over and see what we can do about a couple of the issues you raised. Thanks again, Dick. Who's next? That's it, isn't it? Anybody in the room that would care to testify? Rachel? No? Seeing that, we will close out public testimony but hold the bill over until the beginning of the week. We didn't see this. Came in last night. Back on the record. Next item on the calendar is House Bill 230. We first heard this bill on the 21st of February, and with us we have Representative Paul Seaton. Can you be doing it or do you have help?
Hopefully I can do it.
You're setting a standard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. I really appreciate you being here. Just to refresh everybody's memory, the purpose of this bill.
Name and affiliation, please.
Representative Paul Seaton. I'm a legislator for the southern half of the Kenai Peninsula.
That being Homer?
That being Homer and Inilchik and Sildovia, all those folks. And just to refresh what the purpose of this bill is, to increase the throughput and taps, water constraints on some of the processing facilities on the North Slope, and difficulties accessing some of the others are meaning that we have some small producers that would have the ability to put oil in taps. And what this does is gives a financial way for them to finance processing facilities on the North Slope to increase the flow through taps. And so that's the issue in the bill, and I believe you have some amendments.
And we're going to bring up the four amendments right after we ask if there's any questions for the representative on the original bill. So we have four draft amendments in your packets. Can I have a motion to adopt amendment number one?
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee adopt amendment number one. That being work draft 28-LS1053/uniform.1.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is simply a deletion of the word loan. It was inadvertently put into the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority revolving fund. It's not a loan fund, and so it's simple correction of the title of the fund.
Any questions for Representative Seaton? With that, I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting amendment number one? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Can I have a motion to adopt amendment number two?
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of amendment number two, 28-LS1053/uniform.2.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the purpose of Amendment 2 is to move the definition of oil and gas processing facilities from the statute that we're creating here to the more appropriate place of having it in the general ADA definitions. no change in the definition, just putting it in the proper place.
Any further questions for Representative Seaton on Amendment Number 2? Seeing none, I'll lift my objection. Any further objection? Seeing none, Amendment Number 2 is adopted. Motion to adopt Amendment Number 3.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of Amendment Number 3, that being 28-LS1053/uniform.4.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This simply deletes the repetition of the tax credit language here in this bill and refers to the tax credit provisions 049 in SB 21 that and keeps those provisions the same.
Representative Josephson.
Just for some housekeeping, Amendment Number 3 is the U.4, right?
All
right.
Yeah.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton, the can you explain the purpose of subsection B, the suggested inclusion there, in terms of its direct economic benefit to Alaskans?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, we're looking at the construction of a facility on the North Slope. You know, components might come from other parts that are manufactured outside the state, and those would not be qualified for any tax credit. But combining those together, you know, the welding, the combining into a processing facility is what we're trying to get, so that all it would be there would be the work that was done in Alaska, combining those all the parts. If a module, if parts were made in Alaska, those would qualify for the tax credit. If something came from outside the state, it wouldn't qualify for this tax credit. So it's a combination to get a full processing facility is what we're looking at.
Representative Joseph, we do have Ada online for some specific questions.
Sure. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, my only concern with this is, and it's so far out of sort of my pay grade, although it's not because I'm sitting here, but I'm just curious about whether there's going to be litigation over, you know, a suggestion that this credit's deserving. I just am wondering if it's tight enough so that it reflects exactly what you said, that is, the intent of what you said. Do you have any concerns about that?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, I don't believe so. We've talked to folks, and it seems to be well understood that if you're building a processing facility, that is that's our goal. And when that's combined, and whether it's in a building or whatever, the problem with just A is a tangible personal property and wouldn't be the structure. So you'd have to be segregating out parts of a processing facility. And so this is not intangible property, but it does include the entire processing facility, but only those that expenditures which are made in Alaska.
Ted Leonard, are you with us?
Excuse me, Chair. Yes, Chair.
Thanks for joining us, Ted. Can you state your name and affiliation for the question and then possibly address Representative Josephson's last question?
To the chair, for the record, my name is Ted Leonard, and I am the executive director of ADA. And could the question be repeated, Chair, again?
Certainly. Sure, Representative Josephson.
Yes, Mr. Leonard, looking at Amendment U.4, I'm struck by subsection 3A, which exists now, and refers twice to in-state manufacture, in-state modification, and the proposed subsection B, which doesn't. And I like this bill, and I certainly respect the sponsor a lot. But I'm just curious about that.
Through the chair, again, we discussed this before, Chair, that in reality, this section is definitely not and expertise that Ada could answer questions on the tax credit itself. I think before, I believe that we had someone from revenue. This is part of the statute that isn't under Ada's statutes.
Do we have anybody from revenue online by chance? Oh, and we're working on that. Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't know if Emily from Ledge Legal was on. We discussed this in detail with them.
Emily?
No.
Let's stick around, Ted, but I think we're trying to round up somebody from a different portion of big state government to be a lifeline on this one.
Thank you, Chair. We will.
Thanks again, Ted.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Seaton,
while we're waiting, again, what we're doing is removing this definition that we had in the bill, but we had to repeat the whole tax credit section. And so by just moving it into the 049 tax credit that was already adopted in SB 21, we eliminate all those sections of the bill instead of repeating them and trying to coordinate.
Well, I think we'll take a break at ease until we get somebody on. Now we're back on the record, and we have Emily Nunn, the drafter online. Emily, you probably have no idea what the question is, so we're going to have Representative Josephson restate it.
Great.
Hopefully I can do that.
Oh, could you read yourself onto the record, please, Emily?
Sure. For the record, my name is Emily Nauman, and I'm with Legislative Legal Services.
Thank you for joining us on short notice, and Representative Josephson has a question or two.
Thank you. Ms. Nauman, I'm looking at Amendment U.4. It would include language to the definition of a qualified oil and gas service industry. You know all this because you wrote it. And my question is whether when an audit or accounting of the taxation due is completed, would it be deemed legally significant that subsection A refers to in-state manufacture, in-state modification, and subsection B doesn't?
From an auditing perspective, excuse me, through the chair, from an auditing perspective, I don't know the answer to that question, but it is true that paragraph A requires the event, the taxable or tax creditable event, to occur in the state, while the additional language, the new language proposed in the amendment, does not require the activity to occur in the state. But I don't know what effect that will have on auditing. Perhaps Department of Revenue would be a better person to ask that question to.
Okay. I don't have any other questions for Ms. Kalman.
Thanks again, Emily. Any further questions for Emily while she's on the line?
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton.
If it's a concern, I mean, this is for facility north of 68 degrees north latitude, and we could have, you know, if we're worried about it being in Canada or something, we could put it in Alaska after that, north latitude in Alaska, if that's something you need.
Sure.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. While we have Emily on the line, I might ask to propose a friendly conceptual amendment to the bill. Be appropriate this time while we have the legislative director online.
So you want to ask Emily a question about a potential amendment?
That's correct.
Go ahead.
My question would be this, Ms. Nauman. On page 2 of the version U, page 2, line 2, there's reference to the pipeline. And while I think you and I probably know what the pipeline is, would it be necessary in bill drafting purposes to identify that as the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline, or is that a common enough term that this more clearly defining it's not necessary?
Can you repeat the line number where you're at on page 2?
Yeah, page 2, line 2. And there's a couple references, like on page 4, where it also refers to the pipeline.
I would note that this is legislative intent language, so it's not legally binding, Therefore, it might not have a need to be as specific, but if you'd like to clarify it, we can.
I think the sponsor has indicated he would accept that as a friendly amendment, so I guess I would make that conceptual amendment to change the word pipeline on page 2, line 2, to Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline, and any other place in the bill where it's necessary to clarify the pipeline to the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline.
Is there any opposition to adopting the conceptual amendment number 1, I believe, for the year?
That's correct. I withdraw the conceptual amendment. It's the wrong time.
We got to it in a few minutes. Thanks again, Emily. You might want to stay around for another 15 minutes if it's not too inconvenient.
No problem. I'll be here.
Okay, where are we?
You got four before you. You have objection.
At this point in time, I will remove my objection to amendment U.4. Is there further opposition to adopting amendment U.4? Seeing none, we have adopted U.4, and we're now to conceptual amendment number 1. Would you like to?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would move conceptual amendment number 1 to CSHB 230 on page 2, line 2, deleting the word pipeline, inserting the word Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Likewise, on page 2, line 4, deleting the word pipeline, inserting Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. And any place else in the bill where it's necessary to make that clarification.
Is there any opposition to adopting conceptual amendment number 1? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number 1 is adopted. And that brings us back to public testimony. We still, or actually,
dot brings five. Back,
dot 5.
Good point.
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of amendment number 5, version 28LS1053/uniform.5. Amendment 4, my apologies, correction.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. Got 5.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, this was an aided suggestion because I think you have the note in your packet there. They looked at this and said that their financial folks might interpret this as they could only use revenue bonds, and depending upon the rates that they could get through their ability to do both revenue and GO bonds as their normal process, they would go with whatever would be most financially beneficial to the project. And so this clarifies that it could be used, whatever their bonding abilities are.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Josephson.
Relative to Amendment 5, Representative Seaton, the first deletion there, originally the idea, or I guess existing law, is that facilities could be used to secure bonds, and now they cannot be. Can you explain the reasoning there?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that that's the intent of the amendment, and how they've drafted it. Maybe Ms. Nauman could tell us if there's a different effect than what I just stated was the intended effect, was to put in the suggested language from ADA so that it could be either bond source that they use. So I don't believe that there was an intent to do that.
Ms. Nauman, are you still with us?
Yes. For the record, this is Emily Nauman with Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, for your question, omitting this language doesn't mean that the processing facility flow lines or other surface infrastructure for the facility cannot be used to secure bonds. Rather, the section just becomes silent on whether or not they may or may not, leaving the option open either way.
Through the chair, for Ms. Nauman, I assume the idea here is to give more, just as we have on the flexibility on bonding, to give ADA more flexibility on finance questions. Is that where we're headed? which may be great.
Through the chair, that would be my best guess about the purpose. I don't know exactly why the sponsor asked for this to be in or out. I just followed the instructions.
Yeah. Representative Sadler. Seaton, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you do have in your packet a letter from Ted Leonard, Executive Director of ADIS, stating basically, I think, what Representative Josephson is saying or verifying that. But I believe he's online if you need to talk to him.
Ted, are you still with us?
Yes, Chair.
Would you like the question again, or?
No, Chair. Through the chair, that deletion again is just to assure that the flexibility is there to utilize a general obligation or a revenue bond. The way that sentence is read, it is pretty much our financial advisors say that rating agencies and whoever we'd be selling these bonds to would say that it's a revenue bond based on that language. So this was just to delete that language and then add the new subsection that would state that we could fund this based on the revenues, the project, and it gives just a general description down below on line 19 of that amendment. So, in essence, again, Chair, that this was just to ensure that everyone realized that the bonds issued could be either general obligation bonds of the authority or a revenue bond.
I just have a couple very global questions for Representative Seaton, and then I'm done. If this is a good time.
We'll be shortly.
Okay.
Thanks again, Ted.
Thank you, Chair.
So we're... Now I'm lost. Have we... I'll left my objection to dot 5, dot 4?
Dot 5. Dot 5.
Amendment 4, dot 5. Seeing no further objection, Representative Schnall.
Mr. Chairman, before you do that, let me read this again. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh. Seeing no further opposition, Amendment 4, dot 5 is adopted. Questions for the sponsor, Representative Josephson?
Thank you. Representative Seaton, so the goal here is to give a credit on corporate taxes, not production taxes, up to 10% up to $10 million on this sort of project. Is that the idea?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes, it's to give that 10% credit so that we can stimulate not only in-state work, but also stimulate quicker flow into the TAPS pipeline.
Okay. And through the chair, is it your understanding that based on sort of the lay of the land there, the purpose of this bill is to aid independence more than others?
Representative Joseph, through the chair, when we talk about aiding somebody, I want to make sure that we're not thinking of subsidies, because ADA has talked about 10 to 12% for 10 years, so that's more than we make on most of our investments. So it's not like that we're aiding by losing something from the state, but if we can incentivize a more rapid build-out of processing facilities, which will allow oil to get into TAPS, that's the purpose of this. And it may be one project, it may be more than one. We knew of one smaller independent that this would aid, but there are other independents and there are majors that may have some use as well. The legislature has already adopted the in-state manufacturer credit, and all we're doing is making sure that it is applicable to processing facilities so that we can more rapidly get production into TAPS. Thank you.
Representative Chenault.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not as concerned about the tax credit as what else does the bill do, Representative Seaton? Does it eliminate the capacity for bonding for ADA?
Representative Chenault, through the chair, no. In fact, that was a problem because ADA has a $400 million general cap on bond, and this establishes a separate $200 million for oil and gas processing facility in addition to the $400.
Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may be for
Ted Leonard.
Ted, or for you, either one, Representative. So the limit will be $600 million now would be the taxable on the bond capacity? Or does this actually remove the limit, the bonding capacity for processing facilities?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, no, it doesn't remove the limit. What it does is gives a $200 million for oil and gas processing facilities. They couldn't take that $200 million and invest in some other kind of project other than oil and gas processing facilities. So it's somewhat limited in that respect, so it does not raise their general bonding limit. But if we would have tried to take the $200 million out of their current bonding authority, it would have squeezed many other projects around the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative.
Any further questions for the sponsor? With that, we will open it up to public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, do we have anybody online? I am going to close out public testimony, but hold on to the bill with the intention of getting a clean CS that incorporates all four of the amendments plus the conceptual amendment, so we have something clean to vote on next week and send a clean bill out rather than sending it out for somebody else to do the work on. And with that, we will adjourn at 5:02. Mm.